Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide around the world on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit the webpage georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments right after this message. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and the eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto, and these programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. The income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. And this income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. This income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances. That's in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And the income tax requires that we sign contracts with foreign and alien gods in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. We call those governments. Now, Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36, and Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. And then we're taught to call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it just what it is, covetousness and theft, in violation of Exodus 20, verses 15 and verse 17. You know, God gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers in our Constitution, particularly at Article 1, Section 10, gave us a better way of life than that, and they followed it. And that's why I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice a better way. For more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is also available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of the three-judge courts argument. And Larry Becraft, who wrote this article, you can go to Larry Becraft's website. I don't have the exact address. Just go to Google or somebody. Punch in Becraft. Huntsville, Alabama is where he's located. And he's got quite a little story to tell. He's an attorney. And he's getting to be an old man now. I've known him for 20 years or more. And we talk every once in a while. He sends me a piece and says, here, let me tell you what I found out and this and that. He's interested in such things as income tax and sound money, gold and silver and such things as that. Pretty good old boy. On his webpage, he put a piece out some years back. It was called Destroyed Arguments. It's these arguments that people have been using over and over again and being convicted on. You know, once a case has been decided, once an issue has been decided, you know, that's a losing argument if you go in there and make the same issue that somebody else lost. Now, income tax has three viable defenses. That's Aiken, subjective good faith, Reliance, Murdoch, and 1932, Murdoch versus U.S., and then a third one, religious free exercise, used, of course, according to the rules. And anything other than that to get you into trouble, you're going to lose. That's the bottom line. Unless there's some fourth defense that hasn't been discovered yet. Now, the court might come up with a fourth defense one of these days, or some distinguishing characteristic of the above three. But the three-judge court's argument isn't one of them. And Larry starts off, he says, long ago in the case of Marbury versus Madison, cited at 5 U.S. 137 back in 1803, the Supreme Court considered the question of whether the federal judiciary could decide that a law was unconstitutional, and of course the court concluded that it and the lower courts did in fact have such power. Well, ever since, both state and federal courts, either at the original trial court level or on appeal, have exercised this judicial power to find state and federal laws to be unconstitutional. Well, last time I told you the story about these unconstitutional laws and how they're foisted upon us. Now, Congress possesses the power to establish not only the number of federal courts, but also their jurisdiction. Well, back at the turn of this century, Congress perceived a problem regarding federal courts which were being confronted with certain important issues. Thus, it concluded that it should establish a statutory mechanism whereby a three-judge court could be convened to decide certain important questions, like the constitutionality of a state law. And you'll see the act at 36 Statute 1150 and 1162. The law which was enacted declared that for certain specific types of cases, a party could request a three-judge panel of district court judges to hear and decide the case. Once a decision was made by such a three-judge court, any appeal went directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. However, this law did not disturb in any way the power of a single federal judge to decide the constitutionality of any federal or state law. Well, this law was in effect until August of 1976, when it was drastically modified by Public Law 94-381. And you can read about that in Senate Report 94-204. The new law just simply further limited the type of cases where a three-judge court could be requested. Those cases are those which are specified in certain other federal laws. Thus, while today three-judge courts can be convened, it can be used less frequently. But this modification to the three-judge court did not affect the power of a single judge to declare any law to be unconstitutional. Now, as best as I can tell, a man named Gary DeMott, this guy has gotten lots of people into trouble, formerly of Boise, Idaho, and now living in Salt Lake City, a few years ago started an argument that only three-judge courts established by way of 28 U.S.C. 2284 could decide the constitutionality of any federal or state law. Now, this argument is total nonsense. Now, for example, we all know that Sheriff Richard Mack of Arizona was one of the first parties to challenge the Brady Law after its adoption. His case was assigned to U.S. District Judge Rawl, and this single judge held in Mack versus United States, cited at 856 Fed Supplement 1372 in the District of Arizona back in 1994, that the challenged parts of the Brady Law were in fact unconstitutional. Pending before the court is plaintiff Graham County Sheriff Richard Mack's complaint for injunctive and declaratory relief against the enforcement of 18 U.S.C. 922S, commonly referred to as the Brady Act, for the reasons set forth below. The court finds that subsection 922S2 violates the Fifth and Tenth Amendments of the United States Constitution and will enter partial judgment in favor of the plaintiff on that basis. Unquote. Now, another recent example of a case where a single federal judge held a law to be unconstitutional is found in Condon versus Reno, cited at 972 FedSup 977 in 1997, where District Judge Shedd, S-H-E-D-D, of South Carolina, declared the Federal Drivers Privacy Protection Act to be unconstitutional. The judge said, quote, in this case of first impression, the state of South Carolina and its attorney general, the state's challenge the constitutionality of the Driver's Privacy Protection Act of 1994. Cited at DPPA 18 U.S.C. 2721-25, which regulates the dissemination and use of certain information contained in state motor vehicle records on the grounds that it violates the 10th and 11th Amendments to the United States Constitution. The state seeks a permanent injunction prohibiting enforcement of the DPPA. The United States of America and its Attorney General, the United States, have filed a motion to dismiss based on their contention that, one, the court lacks jurisdiction over these claims because of the justiciability concept of ripeness and standing, and alternatively, two, these claims fail on their merits because the DPPA was lawfully enacted pursuant to Congress's power under both the Commerce Clause and the 5th and 14th Amendment. In turn, the state has moved for summary judgment in its favor. After carefully reviewing this matter, the court concludes that the DPPA is unconstitutional. Accordingly, the court will deny the United States' motion to dismiss, grant the state's motion for summary judgment, and permanently enjoin the enforcement of DPPA in the state of South Carolina. Now, these two cases are not the only ones which prove that single federal district judges have, in fact, the authority to declare laws to be unconstitutional, and they can enjoin enforcement of those laws. And further, there are other similar cases. Now, clearly, the three-judge court position is groundless and without merit, and in short, it is untrue, ridiculous. Now, there is a related note. Some are contending that the U.S. district courts are only Article I legislative courts. This argument was rejected in Smith v. Kitchen, cited at 156 Fed 3rd, 1025 in the 10th Circuit in 1997. All right, now what we're reviewing here are destroyed arguments written by Larry Beecraft of Huntsville, Alabama. You can get the full text of this, and in fact you'll get more than this, on Beecraft's webpage. I've recommended Larry over the years. In fact, several of my students, when they get into deep doo-doo, you know, have gone to Larry and had him defend him, and successfully at that. Successfully. I think Larry Beecraft probably has the best success record of defending criminal defendants on tax charges of any lawyer in America. Now, I could be wrong. There might be some lawyer out there that's got a better track record than Beecraft, but if there is, I don't know who it'd be. The income tax and hard money, gold and silver, are Beecraft's hot buttons. You know, that's what turns him on, makes him tick. And he and I worked together one time years ago out on a job in Colorado. That's where I met him. And he was sitting across the desk from me. We were in the same room. And he said, "God, I can't believe what I'm reading over here." And I said, "Well, God, I can't believe what I'm reading either." And we kind of got to chit-chatting, you know, about the preposterous, absurd positions that we'd been called in to defend. And he said, "This is just nonsense." And I said, "Well, I would agree with that. I'm just a lowly country boy and a law school teacher, but this I don't think is going to fly." And indeed, it didn't. Didn't. And so I'm out here teaching law, and he's out here defending law. And from time to time, he and I have a little conversation, and we chew the rag a little bit, and I kind of disagree with him, or he might disagree with me, but. All in all, he's got a pretty good legal mind, and I think if you go to Beecraft's website, and it's free of charge, you know, it doesn't cost you anything to learn. And what he's trying to do here is educate people in the Patriot movement, you know, boys and girls just like you and me, that if you want to go pursue this argument, that's fine, but be prepared to lose, because the courts have already decided it. It's already been decided. And oftentimes it's decided because we might be on the right side of the issue, but the presentation's incorrect, or we might go in on the left side of the issue and make a brilliant presentation and lose because that's just not the state of the law. And in any case, or in any event, you're going to lose. And the objective for us is that we want to turn out to be winners. So I've got a simple rule that says, follow and do what the winners do and avoid what the losers do. That's what we're saying here. Number 24, the missing 13th Amendment, the titles of nobility. Now, here's an argument, you know, that's been around for a long time. People have said, well, there's this 13th Amendment and it's missing. Well, if it's missing, then your common sense ought to tell you, then it's lost. And if it's lost, then how can it possibly be the law? I think that it's partly a political argument. Let me describe this for a minute. There's a lot of things that go on that are unfair, that aren't right. You know what I mean? They're wrong. And when we see these wrongs, and we look back in history and we say, well, my gosh, the 14th Amendment is just flat wrong. And it shouldn't be that way. Well, you're probably right. I know that there's a political question doctrine that the courts adhere to. And sometimes you'll come in there, and it's been done a couple of times. You know, our Constitution guarantees us a Republican form of government. And we don't have a Republican form of government. We have a democracy. And people have gone into, there's been a couple of cases that went into the Supreme Court and said, hey, listen, we're entitled to a Republican form of government, and we don't have that Republican form of government. Now, Supreme Court, correct that for us. And the court, both times in the cases that I looked up, said, that's a political question. We don't get involved in political questions. And, of course, people accuse the court of judicial legislation. You know, the court in Ashwander versus TVA has worked hard, you know, to avoid judicial legislation. They might be guilty of it a time or two, but, you know, you're going to look a long time before you find it. I don't see that. I don't agree with that. I think Ashwander pretty well answers that question, and I think these two cases on the political question doctrine step into that. No, you might have your opinion, and I might have my opinion, and maybe we disagree. And there are a lot of people out there that have picked up on this missing 13th Amendment over here, and they say, well, this 13th Amendment over here ought to be ruled on, this missing 13th Amendment, by the courts, and they're not going to rule on that. Listen to this. There's much talk on the net regarding the alleged missing 13th Amendment and a related position concerning titles of nobility. Now, I have followed the development of this research since it first got some notoriety years ago, and my views are expressed below. When Bill Benson and I tried to rip the 16th Amendment out of the Constitution, I had to immerse myself into the law of ratification of amendments. First, an amendment's ratification is a decision committed to the political branch of government, Congress. The president and the courts play no role in this ratification process. So when an amendment is proposed in the typical manner, states ratify the amendment and they send notice of ratification to the Secretary of State. Once a sufficient number of states ratify, the Secretary of State proclaims its adoption. Now, the number of states required to ratify an amendment are not limited to those in the Union at the time of the amendment's proposal. And although there is no litigated decision on the point, the accepted scholars declare that states admitted after the proposal of an amendment must likewise join in the ratification process. So it seems that the courts would agree with these scholars. Now, in reference to the missing 13th Amendment, I have, over the years, had a number of people mail me material regarding this issue, which I have studied. In order to prevail on this argument, the proponents must refuse to count states that entered the Union after this amendment was proposed. They limit the number needed for ratification to those in the Union when this amendment was proposed in 1810. But even with this invalid limitation of the number of states needed to ratify, the proponents admit that they cannot prove that Virginia ratified the 13th Amendment. All they have are published copies of constitutions of the period that include this amendment. Now, you cannot prove that an amendment was ratified without having the actual state ratifications of a sufficient number of states to meet the constitutional threshold. Now, if you wish to read my brief regarding the ratification of constitutional amendments, you can click here on my website. The proponents do not have this essential proof of ratification. Now, while this issue is an interesting study, there is absolutely no substance to it. But ignoring the problems regarding the ratification of this amendment, and presuming that it was in fact ratified, what would it mean? The advocates of this argument claim that the term, Esquire, is a prohibited title of nobility within the scope of this non-ratified amendment. These people then argue, as best I can tell, that attorneys, having titles of nobility, are thus agents of some monarch, apparently contending that attorneys really work for the Queen, I presume Queen Elizabeth. This fits nicely into the argument made by the We Are Brits crowd. However, I must note that I have never met an attorney who has met the Queen, let alone been paid by her. But clearly, I have never met the Queen, and she certainly does not send me anything. Now, to prove their position, the Esquire proponents quote the definition of this term from Black's Law Dictionary by way of inaccurate quotes. Now, here is an accurate quote of the definition of this word from Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition, the one I bought while I was in law school. Now, according to this 4th edition Black's Dictionary, this word means, quote, in English law, a title of dignity next above gentleman, and below that of a knight. Also, it is a title of office given to sheriffs, sergeants, and barristers at law, justices of the peace, and others. In the first volume of Blackstone's Commentaries on page 406, on the use of this term in American law, particularly as applied to justices of the peace and other inferior judicial officers. See Christian versus Ashley County, 24 Arkansas 151. Thus, an esquire is lower than a knight. If a knight is not a noble, then clearly an esquire could not be a nobleman. Now, from Webster's 1828 American Dictionary, the word esquire is defined as follows. Properly, a shield-bearer or armor-bearer, an attendant to a knight. Hence, in modern times, a title of dignity next in degree below a knight. In England, this title is given to the younger sons of noblemen, to officers of the king's court and of the household, to counselors at law, justices of the peace, while in commission, sheriffs and other gentlemen. In the United States, the title is given to public officers of all degrees, from governors down to justices and attorneys. Indeed, the title in addressing letters is bestowed on any person at pleasure and contains no definite description. It is merely an expression of respect. Thus, from Webster's, we know that in America, this term denotes nothing but respect and not a title of nobility. Unquote. That's from Webster's 1828 American Dictionary. But the real question which should be asked of this missing 13th Amendment crowd is this. What is a title of nobility? These advocates simply do not want you to know this meaning, because their whole argument would be destroyed and the fraud that they're playing would be plainly exposed. In Black's Law Dictionary, that 4th edition that I cited earlier, the word nobility is defined as follows. It says, in English law, a division of the people comprehending dukes, marquises, earls, viscounts, and barons. This same definition then quotes Blackstone's commentary as authority for what is a title of nobility. quote, these had anciently duties annexed to their respective honors. They are created either by writ, for example, by royal summons to attend the House of Peers, or by letters patent, for example, by royal grant of any dignity and degree of pedigree, and they enjoy many privileges, exclusive of their senatorial capacity. So says Volume 1 of Blackstone's Commentaries on page 396. Now, from Webster's American Dictionary of 1828, nobility is defined in relevant part as follows, quote, the qualities which constitute distinction of rank in civil society, according to the custom or laws of the country. That eminence or dignity which a man derives from birth or title conferred, and which places him in an order above common men. In Great Britain, nobility is extended to five ranks, those of Duke, Marquis, Earl, Viscount, and Baron. It cannot be questioned that the source for both of the above definitions is Blackstone's Commentaries, because he stated at section 533 of his work that the nobles are Dukes, Marquis, Earls, Viscounts, and Barons. Even today, those who are students of nobility agree that there are only five ranks in the peerage. Five ranks in the peerage. So we clearly know that in England, the nobility consists of dukes, marquises, earls, viscounts, and barons. Precisely where is a knight or even an esquire defined as being a part of the nobility? The plain truth is that in English law, an esquire is not a part of the nobility. But in America, the term is meaningless. Again, this esquire aspect of the missing 13th Amendment argument is just another example of very bad legal scholarship emanating from this crazy group in this movement known as the liars. They have titles of stupidity. I got to pause here and make an observation. I think I'd be a little bit more charitable, Larry. I think, a little bit crass to call people stupid. Here's my experience. You know, you and I are common people. I haven't been to college, and because of that, I'm not well educated. And so, you know, a guy like Larry B. Craft, you know, he's been to college, and he's better educated than I am, better educated than most of us. And so he looks at this and he says, well, you guys are all stupid. And I just want to say, we may be ill-informed, we're uninformed, we're ignorant. But I don't think we're crazy. That has a connotation of being insane. And I don't think we're stupid. You know, I know a lot of guys out here, you know, they're pretty good plumbers, carpenters, and electricians. We have been deceived. We've been lied to. We've been defrauded. But I would say that in some cases, you know, crazy might appear, crazy might be applicable, but in most cases, I think we should be a little bit more charitable. So if you've been one of those that have been deceived, lied to, cheated, stolen from, I don't think that you're crazy and I don't think that you're stupid. You've been deceived. Well, it isn't the first time you've been deceived, and it's not going to be the last. In fact, God himself made an observation. It's in Revelation, you know, the last book of the Bible, chapter 12, verse 9. He said, the whole world has been deceived. That includes Larry B. Craft. That includes George Bush and Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer. You know, Satan's a pretty good deceiver. He's a liar, and he's a deceiver. Government lies to us, and they deceive us. Criminals lie to us and deceive us. Now, sometimes they do it intentionally. Now, those are real liars and deceivers. But there's another way that you can be lied to and deceived. You can be lied to and deceived by somebody who actually believes the lie that he's telling you. He's sincere. He's honorable in that. He is not lying to you for his own personal private gain. I remember a guy by the name of Howard Freeman years ago. He's dead now. Heck of a nice guy. I always liked Howard Freeman. I don't think he cared much for me. And Howard Freeman had some, as Larry would say here, he had some crazy arguments, some crazy ideas. And a time or two, we would meet on the lecture circuit, and we had a conversation or two, and I said, you know, I don't think that's true. I don't believe that. I don't subscribe to that. Now, you know, yours truly here, I might be wrong about something, and I don't think I'm crazy, and I don't think I'm stupid because I've been lied to or because I've been deceived. So Howard had been lied to, and Howard had been deceived, and he had some notions about the Uniform Commercial Code, and I pointed out to him, I said, I don't think that's true, and here's why, and I don't think he believed me, and I don't think that he accepted my construction, but nevertheless, I never came to the conclusion that Howard Freeman was crazy or that he was stupid. He was an engineer by training. He was a college graduate. And I've met a lot of people, you know, from college that I don't know if they're stupid, but they're certainly not very bright. Now, my old granddad, you know, only went to the sixth grade, but Henry Ford only went to the sixth grade. You know, back around the turn of the century, the sixth grade was a pretty good grade to aspire to. I don't think Henry Ford was stupid, and I don't think he was crazy. Now, he had some ideas that I didn't subscribe to and I didn't believe. And so did my granddaddy. And I'm sure that Thomas Edison, now he only went to the third grade, and I don't think that he was stupid. I don't think that he was crazy. I'm sure a lot of other people probably would take the other view. So if you've subscribed to one of these views that Larry here sometimes calls crazy and stupid, I think he's aiming that more at the perpetrators. You know, guys like Roger Elvick. Now, I don't know if Elvick actually believes the BS that he's promoting. Maybe he does. Maybe he's got some honor there. But maybe not. Maybe he actually knows better. Maybe he knows that BS is just BS. And so as we look here at these titles of nobility, I think Beecraft's got the winning argument. When you go to the sources and you say, well, what is a title of nobility? The advocates of the title of nobility to lawyers, calling them Esquire, is plainly false, and I agree with Larry Beecraft on this point. I think Beecraft's winning argument is, look up nobility, and in English law they've got five titles of nobility. Five. And Esquire isn't one of them. Okay, Larry, you win that point. And I think that's what rational debate is all about. So just because you haven't done your research, or just because you might not even know how to do it, and you get shown wrong, so what? Is this the first time in life that you've ever made a mistake, for crying out loud? Haven't you ever been wrong before? And then you went to some source and it said, well, here's the truth of the matter. Well, you know, thank God, you know, gee, now I've got the truth. Now I've got the answer to that riddle. I was deceived all of this time. So let's be a little more charitable to people instead of calling them crazy and stupid. You know, let's be reasonable. Deception doesn't equate to stupidity. So we clearly know that in England, the nobility consists of dukes, marquises, earls, viscounts, and barons. Precisely where is a knight or even an esquire defined as being a part of the nobility? The truth is that in English law, an esquire is not a part of the nobility. But in America, the term is meaningless. In England, he's not a part of the nobility. In this country, the term is simply a title of respect. It's like saying to somebody, oh, Mr. Johnson is here. Rather than, hey, old Bill's here. Mr. Johnson has come as a title of respect. Again, this Esquire aspect of the missing 13th Amendment argument is another example of very bad legal scholarship emanating from a group of people that have been deceived. Now, they may be liars, and they may be ignorant. Now, has this argument done damage? Well, I know of a case up in Cincinnati styled United States versus Ed Bradley, B-A-D-L-E-Y. Gar Bradley and another of Ed's sons, now it may be Bradley because in the next line here he says Gar Bradley, so probably it's Ed Bradley rather than Badley. They were indicted in the fall of 1998 for federal tax crimes, and they filed pleadings which were predicated upon this missing 13th Amendment argument. They went to trial pro se in early 1999, and they used this and the non de jure issue, names in all caps, for the 3 weeks that the trial lasted. Now, the jury was back with guilty verdicts in 45 minutes. Jury trial, guilty verdicts. Finally, in reference to this argument, I offer the following, which is the gist of an email to me regarding this issue. It says, very briefly put, the title of nobility amendment was proposed in 1810. There's absolutely nothing in the legislative history to indicate that it was written with lawyers, much less bankers in mind, especially since most of the members of Congress who voted for it were themselves lawyers. In fact, there is very good history that indicates that it was proposed as a direct slap at a Maryland debutante, Betsy Patterson, who purportedly married Jerome Bonaparte, who was the brother to the French emperor and later the king of Westphalia, in 1803, and became the center of mid-Atlantic high society, and as a result, either being called or actually encouraging people to call her the Duchess of Baltimore. By 1808, she was no longer married to Bonaparte, and there might be a small doubt whether there had actually been a marriage, and she gradually slipped into obscurity. Then in 1815, Congress awarded a contract to print up the collected federal laws to a Philadelphia publisher. It was Bioren and Duane who churned out a set of the laws of the United States, and in the introduction there was a caveat that the proposed 13th Amendment was at the time of printing not yet adopted into the Constitution, but it could accumulate the requisite number of ratifications any day now. But this note was about 60 pages removed from the text of the proposal itself, which was simply captioned 13th Amendment, and immediately followed the validly adopted 12th Amendment. These two separated from the main text of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights by many pages of intervening acts of Congress. This could be viewed as sloppy editorial style. Now, apparently, the possibility of misunderstanding the printed layout didn't actually occur to anyone until 1818, when Congress also contracted for a Philadelphia printer to churn out pocket editions of the U.S. Constitution, and this printer, obviously relying upon the Bioren and Duane collection, but not having noticed the introduction, included the 13th Amendment. So when a member of Congress spotted it, he raised a ruckus, and the House passed a resolution asking the president, in this case James Monroe, to report back if this had actually been adopted. Monroe, who had been the Secretary of State, kicked the project over to his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, who conducted considerable research and reported twice in 1819 that not quite enough states had ratified the proposal to accomplish its adoption. So Bioren and Duane, the Philadelphia publishers, had been wrong. Thereafter, no congressionally sponsored printing of the Constitution contained this 13th Amendment, as if it had been adopted. But other printers, sometimes putting the finishing touches on collections of state laws, made the same mistake in the same way. But in 1845, Congress again contracted for an official collection of federal laws, this time with Little, Brown and Company of Boston. The series called Statutes at Large, which is still printed by the U.S. government, and the 1845 edition clearly showed that only 12 amendments had been adopted, and that the 13th Amendment had not been adopted. Because the Little and Brown edition rapidly replaced the Bioren and Duane edition, the occurrence of this error in various editions of the Constitution rapidly diminished. Now, additionally, a number of reliable and authoritative references made clear that only 12 amendments had been adopted up to 1865, including the 1833 commentaries by Justice Joseph Story, which very explicitly said that the 13th Amendment, worth noting, when the Congress was proposing yet another amendment in 1860, had not been adopted. This one for states' rights. It called the 13th Amendment, and nobody then quibbled that the number was already taken, and when that proposal was not adopted, the real 13th Amendment was proposed in 1865, and then again, nobody said that there was already an amendment with that number. Now, if you wish to read a good article regarding the flaws of the missing 13th Amendment argument, then please go to Joel Silversmith's webpage. That's JOLSILVERSMITH webpage. All right, there's that story on the 13th Amendment. Now, as you can see here, Beecraft has spent a lot of time, effort, and energy researching that 13th Amendment. I'll tell you what my conclusion was when I heard that argument years ago. I said, well, my gosh, maybe it's true. Maybe the 13th Amendment was adopted back in 1810, and then somehow or another it was just excluded from the Constitution, and it's been replaced by the 13th Amendment in 1865. But you know, it's like the 14th Amendment. I think the 14th Amendment was bad law and it was a bad practice, and I don't think it should be there, and I think it hurts us. But you know, it's there. Now, I got here in 1939. I don't think I'm going to change the 14th Amendment, and I don't think anybody's going to replace the 13th Amendment as it relates to slavery with the 13th Amendment as it relates to titles of nobility. You know, it's going to take somebody smarter than little Georgie Gordon, and probably somebody as smart as, or maybe smarter than Larry Beecraft, to accomplish that. So my conclusion was years ago, if there's something that's going on out there that's beyond our capacity or control, like the Battle of Armageddon, you know, I'm not gonna prevent it, and I'm not gonna cause it. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna do everything in my power to stay as far away from there as I can get. So I've used the 14th Amendment on numerous occasions. I don't agree with it, and I think it's bad law, and I wish it hadn't been there, but hey, listen, there it is. So take advantage of it, if you can. And the titles of nobility deal. Okay, well, if somebody wants to run around calling himself an esquire, and somebody else wants to call himself a duke and a marquis or something like that, I'm not going to prevent it, and I'm not going to advance it. So I just butt out. What difference does it make? How is that going to affect your life next year, 5 years from now, or 10 years from now? If it's going to do something, then you need to take action. If it's not going to do anything, forget it. Let's get on with something that's more constructive and more important. The main thing that Beecraft pointed out is that it has caused some damage. Some people went into court trying to use that argument, as he would call it, a crazy argument, and they lost. That's tragic. You know, when somebody goes into court and they lose, it impacts upon that person, and he goes to jail. That's pretty severe. You wouldn't want to go to jail. I'll guarantee it. And you don't want to have a heavy fine, have your wife divorce you, lose your house. And many people are going through these penalties. They get divorced. Their families are broken up. They're convicted. They're put in jail. Those are traumatic events. If we could avoid that, don't you think we ought to? Well, we got about 15 minutes here. Hang on, let me tell you another story. Let's see what the story is going to be here. Well, let me tell you this. When people call the law school and they ask how they can learn more about the topics that you hear me speak on over the air, please keep in mind that most of the topics that you hear here on the radio, I teach in detail in one of my schools here at the law school. And by the way, all of these law schools are now on compact disc for adult home study. So when you hear me talking about the common law or Alfred the Great or something like that, remember it was Alfred the Great that codified this common law back in 872 AD into 49 principles or statutes, of which 22 of those principles of Alfred the Great were incorporated by our founding fathers into our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. Now, the common law was taken from the Mosaic Law. It was given to Moses at Mount Sinai. It was recorded in Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8, and it includes negligence, insurance, and taxes, such as income tax, property tax, and social security taxes. Now, isn't that just special? And these IRS tax laws are a counterfeit of the tithing laws of Scripture, and they work a theft on everyone who participates in them. You know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gave us a better way of life than income tax and Social Security, and that's the basis of my tax and status school. We owe this income tax and Social Security tax because we've contracted into them. We signed up for them. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Send me an email. Just click onto the email from the website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send an email request. Remember, put in your mailing address. It's going to go by U.S. Postal Service. Again, that's georgegordon.org, and the telephone number 417-273-4967. Well, I got about 15 minutes here, so let me bring to your attention one of the most common things that we find here that's going on in the Patriot movement is willful failure to file. That's typically where people begin. They come in here and they listen to some patriot group someplace, and then in the final analysis they decide, well, that's probably right, and they stop filing their tax returns. This willful failure to file statute is found at 7203. That's Title 26, Section 7203, and it says, any person required under this title to pay any estimated tax or tax are required by this title or by regulations made under authority thereof to make a record, or make a return, rather, or keep any records or supply any information, who willfully fails to pay such estimated tax or tax, make such a return, keep such records, or supply such information at the time or times required by law or regulations, shall, in addition to other penalties provided by law, be guilty of a misdemeanor, and upon conviction thereof shall be fined. Now, generally, Section 7203 covers four different situations, each of which constitutes a failure to perform in a timely fashion an obligation that's imposed by the Internal Revenue Code. The four categories set forth in Section 7203 are, first, failure to pay an estimated tax, failure to make or file a return, failure to keep records, and failure to supply information. So there's four elements to the statute. Now, with the exception of cases involving willful violations of any provision of Section 6501 of the Internal Revenue Code, all of the offenses under Section 7203 are misdemeanors. So, except for the above-referenced felonies, Section 7203 prosecutions may be initiated either by information or indictment, and reference should be made to Section 25.00 for additional discussion of violations of Section 60501. That's the felony. Now, the charge most often brought under Section 7203 is the failure to make or file a return. And a fair number of cases are also brought under Section 7203 for failure to pay a tax. Now, note that the attempt to evade or defeat the payment of a tax is a felony, and that comes under Section 7201 of the Code. So, willfulness is the same for both misdemeanor offenses and felony offenses under the Internal Revenue Code. Willfulness, intent, is what that's referring to. Intent. The difference in the offenses is that failure to file or pay under Section 7203 involves merely a failure to do something. It's called an act of omission. whereas there must be an affirmative act or a willful commission to raise the offense to a Section 7201 felony. In Sansoni versus United States, cited at 380 U.S. 343, decided in 1965, tells us that story. And note also that by its express terms, Section 7203 does not apply to a failure to pay an estimated tax if there is no addition to tax pursuant to the rules provided for in Section 6654. So failure by individuals to pay an estimated income tax in Section 6655, failure by corporations to pay the estimated tax. Some cases have also been brought charging a failure to supply information, and these are noted below. The charge of failing to keep any records is not commonly used and is not treated separately in this manual. So let me make an observation here. Willful failure to file a misdemeanor is commonly brought up when you deliberately stop filing and paying your income tax. So it's an act that requires an intent. It's an intent crime. So let's take a look at that for a second. When we're talking about intent crimes, it's something that you intend to do. So a crime has two elements to it. A crime. It's an act with intent. It's an act that you deliberately conspire to carry out. Could be an omission in this case. I'm not going to file my tax return. So the government's burden of proof is they got to prove that you knew or should have known, and then that you deliberately failed or refused to carry out a duty that you knew that you had. Well, that's simple enough. So the defense to that is, well, I didn't know that I had to file this tax. Or, as in Aikens versus U.S., which was decided back in 1979, this guy Aikens came along and he said, well, look, I read this book. You know, let's suppose that it was published by Irwin Schiff or somebody else. He says, I read this book and it was copyrighted. And it said that I'm not a person required to file, and I believed that. And I didn't file my tax return. And because I didn't file, now the government wants to prosecute me. Now, the way the government gets around that is that they send you a letter. I don't know of any exceptions to this. I don't know of anybody that's been blindsided by the government on this matter. But the government sends you a letter and they say, hey, listen, we didn't receive your tax return. And so these tax protesters, you know, they'll write a letter back and say, well, I don't have to file this tax. And they'll cite 55 reasons why. And then there'll be some more correspondence with the government. And what's happening here is that the government is collecting these letters from you to be used as evidence against you. That's why I've said in the past, you know, the three rules of pro se litigation is keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. But in most cases, tax protesters are really politicians seeking to overthrow the IRS and the income tax. They're evangelists. They're out here trying to politicize. They're trying to get you to get on the bandwagon and stop filing your tax return. Now, I haven't filed a tax return for many years, but I'm not out here on a bandwagon. I'm not out here on a crusade. I stopped having income. I don't think that it's good for us to practice communism. I don't think that the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for a heavy progressive income tax predicated upon income, is good for us, and I don't think income is good for us. Well, that's a pretty wild new concept, isn't it? So I'm not out here tax protesting and telling you shouldn't file your tax return. My gosh, if you have income, you need to file an income tax return. Now, of course, there's a lot of disagreement as to what in the world is income anyway. I don't have any income, people will say. That argument has been litigated many, many times in the courts. I mean, you know, people have brought in about as many arguments as you can think up. But let me give you some, you know, here's from failure to pay. The receipt of a specified amount of gross income from a government publication. Here's what the government's telling you is income. Income comes from things like compensation for services, including fees, commissions, fringe benefits, and similar items. You can have a gross income derived from a business. You can have gains derived from dealings in property. You can have interest, rents, royalties, dividends, alimony and separate maintenance payments, annuities, income from life insurance and endowment contracts, pensions, income from discharge of indebtedness. Boy, that's a wild one. You can file for bankruptcy. I've got to interject this. You can file for bankruptcy and get discharged $100,000, you know, from your debts. The IRS comes in and says, well, that's $100,000 worth of income that you just had. Now pay your income tax on this discharge of your indebtedness. 13 is distributive share of a partnership in gross income, income in respect of a decedent, and income from an interest in an estate or trust. Now, you know, if we went to the Bible and we took a look at what the Bible has to say about insurance, alimony, dividends, unjust weights and balances, we'd find that those are criminal activities. You know, the income tax is the penalty that we're all paying for the violation of the laws of God. That's what it is on the bottom line. We don't want to tithe, so we get saddled with an income tax. God told us he wanted 10%. And we said, well, we're not going to pay that 10% to God. So we worship a different God, the United States of America, and they take, oh, anywhere from 17 to 75%. And they don't take it in just income tax. There's 14 taxes that we're all paying. 14 of these taxes that take about 75% of everything that we create and produce. So that's why I've come to the conclusion this income's not good for us. The second plank to the Communist Manifesto isn't good for us. Have you ever thought about maybe we ought to stop practicing communism? You know, we didn't have an income tax in this country until we adopted the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, of which the second plank calls for a heavy progressive income tax. We didn't have Social Security until we adopted the 8th plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for a Social Security tax, a tax on the industrial army of America. Well, I'll mull that one over a little bit. I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there. You've been listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Keep in mind that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of the network or of this radio station. Now, for more information about The Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at area code 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at area code 417-273-4967. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to the webpage georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Now, for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Hey, I'm out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.